Yo.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands, narrated by Richard Rowan, with performances by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Nanette Savard, Dylan Lynch, Tim Carlin, David Coyne, James Lewis, Kate Torrey, Thomas Penny, James Konacek, Bruce Rauscher, Michael Replogle, and Mort Shelby. Deathlands number 77, Cannibal Moon. Pistol in hand, Dr. Mildred Wyeth leapt through swirling, acrid smoke. Blistering heat seared through the back of her gray t-shirt and desert camouflage BDU pants. The junked Winnebago RV behind her was swallowed up in a 30-foot-high pillar of flame. Cannies, as cannibals were called in Deathlands, loved babies. And cannies were everywhere. Dark, furtive shapes darted between the bonfires they had made of shanties, lean-tos, and wheelless, rusting RVs. Somewhere in the maze of torched structures, the black woman's five companions fought shoulder to shoulder with the Vilfolk, dealing death to the invaders. Mildred blinked her streaming eyes, every nerve straining. She zeroed in on the sound the children made as they were dragged away. For a split second, she had a clear view of three cannies as they raced past the burning hulk of a station wagon. The two in front carried a squirming child under each arm. The cannie covering the hasty retreat clutched a remade Ruger Mini 14 rifle in both hands. Mildred snap-fired her checkmate ZKR 551 target pistol, taking the only shot she had, and dropped the tail gunner with a single 38 caliber slug in the base of his spine. As she ran toward him, she got a last glimpse of the children's kicking legs and bare feet. Then they and their captors vanished through a break in the log and earth defensive berm. Mildred could no more wait for help from Ryan Carter and the others than she could will her own heart to stop beating. Unless she closed on the cannies quickly, unless she killed them, they would escape into the night with their innocent prey. The flesh-eater she had wounded dragged himself after his fellows, clawing the dirt with both hands, trailing his paralyzed limbs behind him. Mildred jumped over his prostrate body. She didn't bother shooting him in the head. The canny wasn't worth a second bullet. At the edge of the berm, she struggled to pick up their direction of flight. Squinting hard, she could see perhaps 60 feet in front of her. The starlit world was a dim monochrome, varied shades of gray blotched with black. The cannies were heading east, across the wide valley of the Grand Ronde River, probably making for a hidey hole in the densely forested Wallowa Mountains, whose craggy peaks loomed in front of her, blocking out the stars on the horizon. In daylight, the high desert valley was a fairly easy traverse. On a moonless night, it was like crossing a vast, carpet-bombed battlefield. The depressions were deeper and the rises were higher than they looked. The impact of repeated, misjudged footfalls racked Mildred's knee and hip joints. A burning pain stabbed her lungs, but she kept on running full tilt. She couldn't see the cannies, but she could hear them ahead, crashing through the stands of brush. Burdened by their struggling prizes, the flesh-eaters were gradually losing their lead. Mildred's fingers closed around her holstered gun butt. A moment later, a pair of terrified little boys blundered into her path. As she reached out for them, they took to their heels, scattering to either side into the night. At least they had a chance now.
Run and hide!
The fleeing Canes had each jettisoned a child to lighten the load and make better time. Carrying one small victim each, they quickly pulled away from her. They weren't circling or splitting up, trying to throw her off the trail or to catch her in an ambush. Afraid of losing their way in the dark, they were beelining for the foothills. The only signposts were the stars overhead. Mildred guessed they had picked a constellation on the horizon and were running toward it. She did the same, determined to play out the hand she had been dealt, but with fast-fading hope. Ahead was a vast maze of potential escape routes. The extreme northeast corner of Oregon had avoided the leading edge of Armageddon, the all-out U.S.-Soviet nuclear exchange of January 21, 2001. There had been no military installations or population centers to attract the new clusters of Russian MIRVs. Since the mountainous, heavily forested area was 300 miles from the Pacific Ocean, it had also dodged the great tsunamis, spawned by worldwide thermonuclear detonations that had devastated the coastline. Northeastern Oregon had drawn a pass for everything but the earthquakes and a terrible firestorm that had swept through mountains and valley, burning out the little towns in its path, and, of course, the nuke winter that had gripped the entire planet. Even before the end of civilization, it had been a rugged place, thinly colonized. A little farther to the east, the landscape got even tougher. 100 miles away was Hell's Canyon, the deepest canyon in the world, deep enough to hide 20 battleships, stacked one on top of the other. Hell's Canyon also hid a pre-dark redoubt, a vast bunker and storage facility, complete with a functional MATRANS unit. The MATRANS network was intended to move people and materiel across vast distances instantaneously. It was thanks to that system that Mildred and her companions had emerged unscathed into the wilds of Oregon. Most of the pre-dark interstate highways in Deathlands led to uninhabitable ruination. Miles wide, nuke warhead impact craters, skeletonized cities, poisoned water, air, and soil. Highway 84, which cut across northeastern Oregon, through the Grand Ronde Valley, was an exception. Sections of its crumbling roadway still connected minor habitations and nowhere-villes. Out of necessity, it had become a corridor of life and trade. Where there was life in the hellscape, there were predators. Two-legged, four-legged, winged, and slithering. Running in the dim half-light, Mildred wished that Jack Lauren had been by her side. The ruby-eyed, white-haired wildchild could track a rabbit fart in a hurricane. The base of the foothills stopped Mildred's advance. Above her, the slope's blackness wasn't quite absolute. Faint starlight reflected off basalt bedrock, making it look wet. It was not. Ancient lava dikes and arches radiated trapped day heat like a furnace. Above the bedrock were densely treed slopes, fully recovered from the wildfires of more than a century earlier. If the Canes had climbed into the tree line, she knew she would never find them this night. And by morning, it would be too late to save the children.
Come on, you bastards! Where the hell are you?
Then she saw something odd. A flicker of light bouncing off the black rock a couple hundred feet up the hillside. It was there, then it was gone. Not from the stars, because it was the wrong color. Pale yellow instead of dead white. After a minute or two, the light reappeared, then vanished. It was real. The Wallowa Mountain basalt was riddled with caves. Some were little more than shallow dishes. Others were long and winding. A campfire set deep in a cave, perhaps around a bend or two, would give off that kind of weak light. Light that could be completely blocked by some kind of barrier. At least she knew where they had gone. Mildred started to climb, careful not to dislodge any loose bits of rock. If there was an established track to the cave, she couldn't see it. There would be no backup, and no going back. The cave entrance, a low arch in the basalt slope, would have been hard to find even in the daytime. Without the intermittent flicker of light, she might have climbed right past it. No one stood guard outside. The Canes thought they had lost her. Mildred brushed the sweat from her eyes with the back of her hand, then wiped her fingers dry on her BDU pants. By feel, she broke open her revolver, replaced the single spent shell, then softly clicked close the six-shot cylinder. She didn't know how many flesh-eaters were in the cave. Canes usually ran in hunting packs. They used foot speed and the cover of night to snatch away the weakest, the dumbest, the easiest kills. This night, the no-name Vill had been hit by multiple packs simultaneously, all competing for the spoils. Kenny's didn't like to share, and when push came to shove, they ate one another. Mildred reached into her right pants pocket. With her fingertips, she counted four full speed loaders. She took one out and palmed it in her left hand. The ZKR ready to rip, she stooped to enter the cave. Inside the arch, the ceiling was 8 or 9 feet high. The walls were about that far apart, too. There was no guard on duty. Moving quietly, Mildred followed the faint light around a bend. Beyond it, the cave walls necked down, and a ratty brown polyester blanket blocked her path. It hung from the ceiling to the dirt floor, leaking yellow points of light from 100 holes and small rips. Mildred stepped up and peeked through a hole in the blanket. It took a couple of seconds for her eyes to adjust to the glare of light, which came from a stone-ringed fire pit in the middle of a wide chamber. She counted 4 cannies. She couldn't tell whether the cave went on or dead-ended. Strewn in a corner was a pile of fire-blackened human bones. From the angle she had, she couldn't see the children, but the whimpering was definitely theirs. With a sweep of her hand, Mildred pushed back the blanket, looking over the ZKR's sights. She caught the cannies flat-footed. The closest canny, a tall man with a bushy foot-long beard, took the up-angled round through his left eye socket, and he toppled over, rigid from head to toe with shock, like a felled tree. 2 others leaned over a boy and a girl who were huddled in a corner. The cannies whirled at the gunshot, the slivers of filleting knives flashing in the firelight. Muzzle Climb was her old and trusted friend, and she rode it onto the 4th target who had grabbed up a blaster and was coming at her fast. As the canny charged, he swung the side-by-side scattergun from the hip. The full-length weapon came around slowly, way too slowly. Dead on his feet, he dropped to his knees, then crashed in a cloud of dust at her boot tops. With the ZKR aimed at the ceiling, she broke open the cylinder and flicked out the smoking empties. Muzzle down, her feet braced wide apart, her steady, deft fingers fitted the speed loader in place and twisted the cartridge release. She felt a rush of breeze on her neck as the blanket over the entrance whipped aside. In the next instant, something heavy slammed into the back of her head. Her knees buckled under her. Everything went black. She didn't feel the ground when it flew up and hit her in the face. When Mildred opened her eyes, the world spun madly around her. She had a splitting headache. She tried to focus and was overcome by a wave of nausea. Shutting her eyes, she leaned back against what felt like a rough wooden post. It was wedged tightly between the cave floor and the ceiling. Her wrists were lashed around the post behind her, her ankles lashed to its base. The bonds were skillfully tied. There was no wiggle room, and no stretch whatsoever. As she waited for the vertigo to pass, she recalled the seconds prior to her blackout. She had been poleaxed from behind, and that was the source of her throbbing headache. Opening her eyes again, she looked up into a gaunt, unshaven face. At that moment, she realized that a possible skull fracture was the least of her worries. The canny's right cheek was marred by a burn scar, a swath of shiny pink pockmarked skin where whiskers no longer grew. To Mildred, it looked like a near miss from a close-range black powder discharge. A victim fighting for his or her life had failed to hit the point-blank 10-ring. The canny had no eyebrow or eyelashes on that side. His right eyelid was shriveled to nothing, and the eyeball was milky white, like a hard-boiled egg, cooked in its socket by a flash of Pyrodex. The bastard's breath stunk like a 3-week-old corpse. But that wasn't the worst of it. Stalactites of gray hung glistening from both his nostrils. The thick discharge had smeared and crusted like a snail trail through the dark stubble that covered his upper lip and chin. He was infected with the scourge of Deathland's cannibal clans, a contagious, blood-borne, inevitably fatal disease known far and wide as the Oozies. Mildred looked past him. There were 2 more cannies, live ones. The trio had entered the cave as she had started shooting, probably rejoining their running buddies for a share in the spoils. With no one covering her back,
She had left herself open to attack. The two kids were still alive, huddled in each other's arms on the dirt floor, crying softly. From stories told on their mother's knees, they knew what was coming next. The scarred one smiled down at Mildred, showing off yellow incisors filed to points. He was the pack leader, the Alpha. Without a word, he reached around her hip and groped her buttocks, not in a sexual way. His interest was entirely culinary. Mildred tried to twist away from his powerful fingers. He squeezed harder until she stopped struggling. Then he let go.
She a tough one. We gotta pit roast her. Slow fire, wrapped in wet leaves. Let it cook all day.
The other two cannies stepped closer. They had hollow-cheeked faces, skinny arms and legs, bloated pot bellies.
Or we could slice her into steaks, pound them flat with a rock, and quick fry them in baby fat.
The third Kenny licked his cracked lips. He had a narrow groove across his forehead where the bone had been crushed by a blow, perhaps by a tire iron or a piece of rebar. Mildred looked from face to grimy face. Gray pendulums of snot swayed from their noses. Gray discharge leaked from their filthy ear holes. They were all goners. Terminal stage oozies. There had been no such disease in the scientific literature when Mildred Wyeth had graduated from medical school. There had been no such disease when years later she had undergone a relatively minor surgical procedure and had experienced a negative reaction to the anesthetic. In a last-ditch attempt to save her life, her colleagues had put her in cryogenic stasis. That had been shortly before the cataclysmic events of January 21, 2001. After sleeping through the end of Western civilization, and a century or so thereafter, she had been revived by Ryan Cotter and the others, reborn into a strange and violent new world. Medical science no longer existed. What information there was anecdotal and unsubstantiated. Rumors and lies, lies and rumors. From her own limited experience over the years, Mildred had come to no conclusions about the true nature of cannies or their fatal affliction. They didn't exhibit the gigantism or chimerism found in Deathland's other mutated species. Superficially, at least, their flesh-eating seemed more like an addiction. One taste of human flesh and they were forever hooked. Oozy infection only seemed to increase their depravity, giving them a bottomless hunger. In human history, cannibalism was almost always a ceremonial choice, Mildred knew. Eating one's fallen or captured enemies was a way of taking their physical and spiritual power. It was never the mainstay of diet. Epidemiological studies that might have answered the questions about cannies were no longer an option. That kind of research had vanished forever, along with the Centers for Disease Control. Dr. Mildred Wyeth stood disarmed and helpless, facing a truly horrendous fate. But she wasn't thinking about herself, nor about how far she had come to die so miserably. She was thinking about the children. The only way she could protect them was by getting eaten first. There was still a remote chance her companions would track her to the cave before the cannies got hungry again.
I did your packmates a favor when I blew them apart. It was mercy killing. You ought to thank me for easing their way to hell. Dying from the oozies is triple hard, as you boys are finding out. First come the uncontrollable hand tremors, then you start shitting yourselves. You can't digest human flesh anymore, but you can't eat anything else. You eat more and more, but still you slowly starve until you're too weak to fight off the blades of your own blood brothers.
We've been final stage for over a year, still hunting strong. Took our medicine.
There's no drug for what you've got. It's turning your brains to pus. That's what's dripping onto your boots.
You don't know shit about shit, lamb chop.
Let's eat the bitch first. Pay her back for chilling half our crew. The kids will keep.
Oh, I got a much better idea.
The leader pulled a long knife from a sheath hidden in the top of his lace-up boot. It was a pre-dark K-bar combat knife with a black handle. Alpha knelt beside the first Kenny Mildred had shot. He lifted the dead man by the armpits, holding the torso propped upright. Using the knife's blue steel pommel, he pulped the residue of brains left in the cratered skull. When he was satisfied with the result, he tipped the man's head, slopping the lumpy mess into a tin plate.
Old Tom here is gonna have his revenge. Open him out.
Mildred went rigid against the pole. She clenched her teeth with all her might.
Open up, bitch!
20 filthy fingernails couldn't pry her jaws apart. 4 hands couldn't hold her head still. Alpha broke the stalemate, sucker-punching her in the stomach. The others exploited her moment of weakness. Baldy pulled down her bottom jaw. Rebar Head forced a thick stick crossways between her back molars. Mildred couldn't snap the stick and close her mouth. She couldn't dislodge it by shaking her head. She flexed her throat muscles, shutting her gullet, her eyes wide with panic. Then came the metallic taste of the plate on her tongue, followed by warm goo flooding her mouth. Before she could cough out the pureed brains, hard fingers pinched off her nostrils and a calloused palm covered her mouth. Mildred's stomach heaved violently, but she couldn't expel a single drop. The resulting explosion of pressure only drove it up into her sinuses.
How do you like it?
The taste of death was shrill, feral, fecal. The stench in her nose burned like battery acid. With a hand shutting off her air, it was either swallow or suffocate. She wanted to suffocate, but the choice wasn't hers to make. Her nervous system's hardwiring wouldn't allow it. Just before she passed out, she swallowed.
You've been dosed good!
Oh, you'll be hungry for long pig in no time.
The Uzis might kill me, but it won't make me a red plastic canny.
You think cannies are born that way? Shit. Which came first, the canny or the Uzis? Guess you're gonna find out. Throw some more wood on that fire. Let's get something cooking. I don't know about you guys, but I'm fucking starving.
Ryan Carter followed in Jack Lauren's footsteps, trying hard to keep up, his Sig Sauer P226 blaster in hand. Behind Ryan in a tight single file was the remainder of the companions. Christy Roth, Ryan's red-haired, emerald-eyed lover, was wrapped in a long, shaggy black coat and carried a Model 640 38 Smith & Wesson revolver. John Barrymore Dix, Ryan's comrade since the days of riding with Traitor's Convoy, had his trademark fedora screwed down on his head. His military-style M4000 shotgun swung on a shoulder sling. Theophilus Algernon Doc Tanner, Oxford scholar circa 1881 and reluctant time traveler, brought up the rear in his tattered frock coat and cracked riding boots. In one fist he held a massive Civil War relic black powder hand blaster, in the other an ebony walking stick that concealed a rapier blade. One of their number was missing. They wouldn't rest until they recovered her. Christy had watched Mildred vanish into the night, chasing a pair of cannies who carried off 2 young children each. Pinned belly down by withering blaster fire, the tall redhead couldn't go to her friend's aid, and in the deafening clatter of the exchange, couldn't summon the others to help. It wasn't until almost half an hour later, until after the attack had been beaten back and the cannies driven out of the Ville's berm, that Ryan and the companions had regrouped and begun the pursuit. They had covered less than 100 yards when Jack called a halt to the advance. Kneeling, he holstered his .357 Magnum Colt Python and carefully examined the narrow strip of churned-up ground.
Cannies dropped the kids.
No bodies here. They must have been alive. Looks like they got away.
Canny tracks both heavy on one leg.
They're still carrying a kid each. I saw them take 4 from the Ville.
I wonder why our Mildred did not stop to round up the escapees.
They probably hit the ground running. Even if she saw them, she couldn't catch them in the dark.
That way.
Jack pointed due east. The companions resumed the chase. They moved triple fast and triple quiet as Jack led them across the valley, toward the dark screen of mountains. As Ryan ran, he thought about the Ville they had just left and the dozens of bodies strewed in its rutted dirt lanes. How many of its folk had died fighting? How many had been carried off to meet a worse fate than a bullet? How many women and children had either been suffocated by smoke or burned alive in their underground hiding holes? The exact cost of victory was impossible to count until after daybreak, which was still hours away. The shambling shacks could be rebuilt, of course. The stacked logs and heaped earth of the defensive berm could be repaired, and its design much improved. But Ryan knew it would take years to restore the human population to its former size. All the while, with flesh-eaters hammering at the gates. Taking the battle to the Cannies, finding their dens and killing them one by one, was the only way to tip the balance. It was a daunting task, given the mountainous terrain and their apparent numbers. Even before the attack, there hadn't been enough Vilfolk to handle the job. Unlike Deathland's numerous mutated species, Cannies were still essentially human beings. Humans gone psycho-renegade. They fought with blades and blasters instead of teeth and claws. This night, they had been particularly well-armed with semi-auto and full-auto centerfire weapons. Several of them weren't remades. Over the years, after numerous skirmishes, Ryan had Cannies pegged as cunning, cowardly adversaries. Their normal strategy was hit and get, like true pack-hunting predators. Cannies worked a vulnerable territory until it could no longer support them, or until they were killed or driven out. Because they looked human, Cannies sometimes infiltrated Vils and mingled with norms, then struck without warning. Children and the dim-witted simply disappeared overnight. Cannies were blood traitors to their own species, universally despised and feared. The happy downside to the canny lifestyle was the oozies, a horrible wasting disease that ultimately claimed them, one and all. It was widely assumed that they got it from eating the infected brains of their own packmates. No one knew their exact origins. From the time-honored campfire tales, it appeared Cannies had been around since Skydark, when Nuke Winter had forced the surviving humans to make awful choices about protein sources. Although the companions had come across isolated small bands that roamed Deathland's interior, Ryan had never seen or heard of Cannies unleashing a coordinated mass attack on a bermed vill. Their organization had always stopped at the pack level, the primary hunting group. The hellscape was full of mysteries. Explanations, when they came, were usually incomplete. Jack somehow picked out Mildred's trail in the weak light, leading the companions across the high desert valley on a near-dead run. How the albino managed the feat was a puzzle to Ryan, especially after Mildred had explained her 20th-century understanding of albinism to him. Before the apocalypse, it had been a well-documented genetic disorder, caused by a random mutation that stopped production of a chemical vital to normal development of skin pigmentation, eyes, and brain. According to Mildred, pre-dark albinos always had poor vision, were susceptible to sunburn, and had blue-gray or brown eyes. Jack had exceptional eyesight, and his eyes were ruby red. The youth vehemently insisted that he wasn't a mutie. Those with mutie blood were Deathland's untouchables, often chilled on sight. But the evidence said otherwise. Whether he was seeing the bootprints in the sand, or smelling out the track, or using some other extra-norm sense that had no name, Jack was bird-dogging. The pace he set was grueling, but no one complained, and no one asked for a rest. Ahead, the impenetrable black of the mountain crags loomed larger. The landscape tilted underfoot, and the companions began to climb the gradual incline of the valley side. As the physical effort increased, body heat built up. Sweat peeled from Ryan's hairline, down his forehead, burning into his good eye. The other socket was an empty hole, covered by a black leather patch. Ryan ignored the growing ache in his thighs, pushing the pain aside as though it belonged to someone else. Mildred Wyeth was more than a treasured friend, more than a trusted comrade in arms. She was a resource the companions couldn't afford to lose. Mildred had been a physician. She understood the workings of pre-dark science and technology. She had come from a time not only with different knowledge, but very different values. Would any of the other companions have taken off on their own to rescue the children? Maybe, maybe not. When the five reached the base of the mountains, they paused for breath, their faces upturned, searching the black vastness above.
Where'd she go?
Jack tugged on Ryan's sleeve.
There, cave mouth.
Above them, weak firelight flared against bedrock. Then it was gone. They all saw it.
How can you be positive that's where Dr. Wyeth has gone?
Can't.
That fire didn't start itself. There've got to be Cannies hiding inside. Nobody else would be out in the bush around here.
Nobody in their right mind.
We need to have a look-see. Spread out. Take it slow. Make sure of your footing. We don't want any rock slides on the approach.
The companions climbed the mountain flank, closing in on the cave entrance with guns raised, safeties off. They saw no movement and met no resistance. The Cannies weren't expecting company. Probably because they considered themselves well hidden and figured no one would try to hunt them down before dawn. As Ryan neared the cave mouth, he smelled wood smoke, charring meat, and burning hair. His stomach twisted into a knot.
Oh no, not Mildred.
Ryan ducked under the low arch, entering the outer chamber, where the trapped smoke and stench hung like an evil fog. When all the companions were inside the arch, he led them through the smoke toward the source of the flickering yellow light. Around the cave's bend, they spread out on either side of the blanket that served as a door, their weapons aimed, fingers resting lightly on triggers. Holding the Sig Sauer braced against his hip, Ryan leaned forward and peered through a rip in the fabric. He saw two men, one bald and the other with a badly scarred face, crouched on the far side of a roaring fire. There had to be a vent in the ceiling, he thought, a fissure in the rock drawing most of the smoke up and out. The Kennys were eating with their bare hands, pulling greasy strips of charcoaled meat off the shoulders of a human corpse. They had removed the dead man's clothing, but hadn't bothered to cut up his body. They had simply shoved it into the fire like an oversized log, burning it at one end, flame roasting the head and upper torso. A third Canny stood with his back turned to the entrance. When Ryan saw Mildred tied to the post, the weight on his shoulders lifted. She was still alive. The children were huddled in a corner, still alive too. Ryan turned to the companions and held up three fingers. Three targets.
Mildred?
The one-eyed man gave the thumbs up. At his signal, Christy ripped down the tattered blanket. Ryan and JB burst into the death chamber, shoulder to shoulder. Before the bald canny could stand, JB blasted him full in the face with a load of double-aught buckshot. The canny jerked violently backward, a plume of skull and brains flying. The scar-faced canny was already moving sideways, lunging for a nearby weapon. JB's buckshot missed its intended target by a foot. Instead of taking off his head, the blast slammed the canny in the left shoulder, bowling him over as a cloud of dirt and rock dust rained from the ceiling. The creature landed hard and stayed down. The remaining flesh-eater lunged toward the children through the swirling dust, his knife blade drawn. A pair of tightly spaced 9mm rounds in the head blew the canny off his feet before he could cut throats. He crashed into a pile of bones at the base of the wall and lay there twitching. Doc rounded the fire pit and covered the wounded canny with his double-barreled Lama. Christy gathered up the children. Drawing his 18-inch ponga from its leg sheath, Ryan stepped over to Mildred. There was blood on her chin. The glistening stripe ran down the front of her neck and onto her t-shirt, which was speckled with pink bits of bone. She reeked of vomit.
Are you okay? Are you wounded?
Mildred shook her head minutely, but she wouldn't meet his gaze. Ryan had fought side by side with this woman in countless pitched battles. Under fire, Mildred was intense, determined, fearless. He had never seen her like this in the aftermath of combat. Numbed, shell-shocked. What had the bastards done to her? He wasn't the only one who noticed the change. There was concern on JB's face as he returned Mildred's revolver to her.
You did good. It all worked out.
Mildred holstered her revolver. She let her arms drop to her sides. Then she slumped back against the wooden post, utterly deflated. JB stared helplessly at the dazed, blood-smeared physician.
Mildred?
For Nuke's sake, Jack, drag that stiff out of the fire. Stop that rat-blasted stink.
Jack grabbed the corpse by the heels and pulled it from the blaze. Then he kicked dirt on its smoldering head.
Who was he? Mildred?
Kenny, I shot. The others decided not to let him go to waste.
Doc loomed over the sole canny survivor, holding the Lamar shotgun barrel against his temple, and down-angling the load of blue whistlers so as to empty his cranial vault top to bottom. As the old man cocked the black powder blaster's hammer, Alpha twisted his head around so he could look his executioner in the face.
Kiss my ass.
Prepare to meet your maker, devil spawn!
Suddenly, Mildred came to life, lunging forward with arms outstretched.
No! Don't kill him!
Forgive me, my dear. I didn't mean to presume. You will, of course, wish to do the honors yourself.
As Doc stepped away from the wounded canny, he made a sweeping gesture with his ebony swordstick, gallantly inviting her to have at her revenge. Mildred advanced on the monster with gun drawn. Ryan was gratified to see her back in action. His relief was short-lived.
When you gonna tell him, Mildred? When you gonna tell him our little secret, huh?
No one said a word. Her longtime companions looked on in astonishment. In the space of a couple of minutes, Mildred had gone from devastated to near demonic, and in the process, turned her physician's oath on its head.
Get him up on his feet!
JB and Jack scrambled to hoist the Kenny from the cave floor. Raising her arm, threatening to continue the beating, Mildred backed the monster against the post.
Tie him tight, Jack.
Jack cinched wrists and ankles to the rough-hewn pole. When the Kenny was immobilized, Mildred's fury seemed to ebb. She viewed the blood on her gun sight with deep, deep disgust. She scooped up a dead man's rag of a shirt and quickly wiped the muzzle clean.
I need to talk to Ryan.
So talk.
I need to talk to him alone.
We'll wait outside the cave then.
No. Ryan and I've got things to do here, just the two of us. It's going to take a while, and it's going to get loud before we're done. I don't want the children to hear and be scared all over again.
Take the kids back to the Ville, Christy. Find their parents if they're still alive. Jack, Doc, JB, go with her.
Not a good idea for you two to stay here by yourselves.
I concur most emphatically. We either should all go or all remain for safety's sake.
We've got plenty of ammo. Daybreak's not far off. We'll be fine. We'll catch up with you in the valley.
The companions didn't like leaving them behind, but there were no more protests. Mildred had earned herself a private face-to-face and private payback, if that's what she wanted.
We'll see you back at the Ville, then.
With a wave of his arm, JB led the others out of the cave. Christy touched Mildred on the hand as she herded the wide-eyed children past her.
You saved them. You saved them, and you survived. You did great, Mildred.
After the companions had filed out, Ryan threw another hunk of wood on the glowing coals and watched it slowly ignite.
What's going on, Mildred?
Something real bad.
Figured that.
I wanted to tell you about it first. I need you to make me a promise. I need you to give me your word on something.
Of course.
Before you and the others got here, the bastards force-fed me canny brains.
Ryan felt the bottom drop out of his stomach. The puzzle had been solved, albeit horrifically. Now he understood why she had acted with such uncharacteristic savagery.
They were infected brains, Ryan. Terminal stage oozies. Three of them ganged up after they had me tied to the post. They made me swallow a plateful. Afterwards, I vomited up as much as I could. But chances are, I'm infected.
Ryan reached out to comfort her, but she backed away.
I don't know how long it'll take for the oozies to manifest. I don't know what will happen when the infection starts to spread through my brain.
You didn't have to keep this from the others.
Yes, I did. We've been together too long, covered too much ground, been through too much hell. I trust every one of them with my life, Ryan, but not with my death. I'm afraid they might wait to do what needs to be done, out of friendship or love or misplaced sympathy. I won't risk that. I don't know how long I can fight off the disease. I may not know I've lost the battle until it's too late for me to do anything about it. What I'm saying is, I may be too weak or too crazy to eat my own gun, Ryan. I want you to promise me you'll do the job when the time comes, without hesitation or mercy. Will you do that for me?
It wasn't a deed Ryan wanted on his conscience. It made his head reel to even contemplate it, but he couldn't refuse her. He concealed his reaction behind a mask of stone and looked her straight in the eye.
You got it, Mildred.
And there's something else. It's the reason I stopped Doc from killing that one.
I wondered why you stepped in like that. After what the bastard did to you, why you didn't shoot him yourself.
When they had me tied up, the canny started talking about their condition. They claimed they had medicine for the oozies. They didn't elaborate on what it was or where it came from. They said it kept them alive, even though they had been in final stage for over a year.
Is that true?
Ryan turned and addressed the filthy, scarred man tied to the pole.
It probably was idle talk, something they made up to mess with my head. Or maybe they came across some carny show snake oil, drank it down, and are hoping against hope. On the other hand, it just might be something real. Ryan, I know it's a hell of a long shot, but I've got a short list of options. I'm looking at a triple nasty ride on the last train west. It's a journey I surely don't want to make.
Ryan said nothing. He'd seen a few victims of end-stage Uzis in his time. Based on that experience, if he'd been the one infected, he knew he'd have been grasping at straws too.
I tell you everything if you just snip off one of them nice crispy ears and pass it over to me.
Shut up, or I'll saw off your red-blasted foot and make you eat that, boot and all.
The one-eyed Kenny grinned back, showing off the bloody slivers of his fractured incisors.
You can't do anything to me that I will purely enjoy.
You're wrong there. If we do absolutely nothing, you're going to purely hate it. And sooner or later, you'll tell us everything we want to know.
You got a name, shitbag?
I got two names. My ball name and my hunting name.
Take it from me. Your hunting days are done. What name were you born with?
Georgie Thibodeau Jr. From the Zianna line of Thibodeaus. Though if you ask my mom and pa about me, I suppose they would deny I was ever born.
You're a long way from home, Kenny.
Been walking the Red Road for years.
What road?
You never heard of the Highway of Blood? It's the path all Kennys take, the path we make. It stretches from here to there.
There?
The homeland.
And where might that be?
Thibodeau squinted his good eye up at Carter's face.
You know, I should get me a patch like that. Got some style. Better keeps dirt and crap from falling into the hole, too. You know you folks broke in before I could finish my morning snack. Come on, brother. Use that big sharp blade of yours and hack me off a hunk of one of them deadens. Don't let that good meat go to waste.
Interrupting the Kenny's calorie intake was the whole idea. Ryan and Mildred took seats on flat rocks near the fire and propped up their boots, settling in for an extended rest. At first, Junior Thibodeau remained sullenly quiet. Unable to backhand away his nasal excretions, he let them trickle down his unshaved upper lip. Ryan and Mildred didn't have to discuss the interrogation strategy. They both saw the same weakness in their enemy, and the same way to exploit it. When infected cannies neared death, they reaped so little energy from their food that they had to eat almost non-stop. No matter how much they ate, they were in a state of perpetual near-starvation. Junior Thibodeau was a tough nut. He didn't buckle under the psychological pressure, the anticipation of the terrible agonies to come. It took almost 6 hours on the post for his hunger pangs to become unendurable. Mildred and Ryan watched him sweat, squirm, shiver head to foot. They listened as his high-pitched whimpers turned to guttural moans. And when Junior couldn't stand it anymore, it was like a dam breaking.
Do you really think this is how I dreamed of ending up when I was little? Tied to a pole in a stinking cave with my shoulders shot, my belly on fire? Maybe I deserve to die triple hard because of what I've done. But I had no choice. I didn't wake up one day and decide to be a canny. Woke up, and all there was one. Maybe you don't want to believe it, but I'm as much a victim as the stupid bastards I've made my meat. That very first night, years ago, when cannies came to our swamp, they could have butchered me on the spot, but they didn't do me that favor. I was night fishing by myself down by the river. I just set my snag line when I heard them sneaking to the mangroves along the mud bank. It was too late to get away. I can't swim a stroke. They had me sandwiched, all of them with blasters and long blades ready. I thought for sure they were gonna eat me then and there. But that wasn't what they had in mind. Turned out that they needed another hunter to fill out their crew. If I'd said no to joining the pack,
They would have sun-dried strips of my flesh on the bushes and turned me into jerky. I didn't taste human being that night. Oh, though there was plenty of eating going on. I ran with the pack, hanging back a little and watching what they did. How they hunted the tiny shit-scrabble farms on the edges of the swamp. How they swept through the ramshackle buildings, chilling as a team. Some counties ain't way more about it than others. They were the sick ones. I was back in my bed in my folks' shanty before sunup, with no one the wiser. It was triple hard getting to sleep. All I could think about was running free and wild. I'd seen a different world through different eyes. I woke up feverish and dripping sweat the next morning. Through the heat of the day, my whole body throbbed. It felt like it was gonna explode. I just lay there on my straw and panted like a dog. The coolness of evening eased my fever, but not the pressure inside me. At dark, when the candies came back for me, I was shivering. I was so ready to join the hunt. When they asked about easy pickings close by, I told them about a little Demi boy I knew who lived with his pa on the other side of the swamp. I told him the Demi was blonde-haired and freckled. A couple weeks later, I would have just called him a 100-pounder. That's a gutted hanging weight. I tricked the Demi boy into coming out of his shack by standing at his window and calling his name real soft. He knew me from night fishing, so he didn't suspect nothing. I got him over to the edge of the woods, and when his head was turned, I whacked him on top of the head with a steel hatchet. I split his skull wide open with the first blow. Before he could yell for help from his paw, he was sitting in the shack sipping jar juice not 50 feet away. The Demi was still twitching a little when me and the others dragged him deep into the thicket. We picked at his bones until dawn. One taste of long pig and I had to have more. I never went back home. Never saw my kin again. I've been on the Red Road ever since, with this pack and Dad.
Along the way, it looks like somebody managed to royally fuck you up.
Brother, the way you look, you must have pissed somebody off too.
Ryan shrugged.
I got this face 3 years ago. Dirt farmer heard our pack coming through a cornfield and took the kids down in the root cellar to hide. We shot holes through the wooden door until we figured we must have nailed her. When I opened the hatch, everything was quiet below, so I jumped down for a look-see. About then, her oldest son cut loose with a black powder hand blaster. He got off one shot before I had a hold of him. His pistol ball missed my head by a gnat's ass, but the muzzle flash caught me square in the peeper. Felt like hellfire burning into my brain. Oh, I screamed, but I didn't let go. The others had to pry my fingers off the kid's busted neck so they could fry him.
Maybe I should just go ahead and kill this filthy bastard.
That's your call.
Brother, your woman there ain't telling the whole story.
About what?
The Uzis.
Mildred, what's he on about?
According to Junior, the Uzis does more than kill. He claims it turns norms into cannies. The infection comes first, then strict cannibalism, and finally the array of debilitating symptoms leading to death.
Either you ever see a gnome with the Uzis?
Is that even possible, Mildred?
Hypothetically, I suppose it is. If the Uzi virus permanently alters the brain chemistry of its victims, it could affect sensory perception, ideation, and ultimately behavior.
Oh, fucking hell.
You got it. If what Junior says is true, sooner or later, and long before I'm dead, I'll end up just like him.
I'm not gonna let that happen. No fucking way.
Rising to his feet, Ryan unsheathed his panga. He leaned over one of the dead cannies and smeared the heavy blade with congealing blood. He waved the bloody knife under Junior's nose.
Is this what you want?
Junior craned his neck as far forward as he could. He opened his mouth wide and started to drool. The look on his face said he would have eaten his own hand if he'd been able to reach it.
Where did the Uzi medicine come from?
It's all a lick, brother. I tell you all about it for one little lick.
Answer the question, then maybe I'll give it to you.
Got the medicine down in the homeland, from La Golondrina.
What's La Golondrina?
Who? She's a who. Give me my lick.
Junior thrust out a gray-coated tongue, stretching, stretching. When Ryan pulled back the glistening panga, the Kenny started to shake violently from head to foot.
Stop playing games, shitbag, and spill it.
Like Golandrina's a freezy. As far as anybody knows, she was the first case of the Uzis. She came down with the sickness before the new cast. She was the very first Kenny, too. Did some hunting on her own down in southern Sienna until the pre-doc Law caught up with her. Law turned her over to the White Coats for testing. They couldn't cure her, and they were afraid the disease might somehow get out and spread. The legend says they put La Golondrina into some sort of deep sleep when she was in the last stages of dying. She was frozen, sort of. She woke up about a year ago after there was some sort of malfunction. She still had the Uzis, but it was too weak to chill her.
What's that got to do with the medicine you took?
One drop of her precious blood keeps 100 of us alive, brother. The word about La Golondrina's healing power spread from pack to pack, all across Deadlands. Kenny started pilgrimaging from the farthest corners to find her and be saved from the Grey Debt. They're still coming.
Ryan turned and gave Mildred a dubious look.
There had to be a patient zero, Ryan, an initial human case. If this woman survived, whether because of the freezing or thawing process or the duration of her cryosleep or some other unknown factor, she had to have produced antibodies to the disease. If Uzi-infected blood can kill, blood with Uzi antibodies can save. Do you have to take the medicine more than once to be protected, Junior? Does its effect wear off over time?
I don't know. I only taken it the once. 4 months ago. I haven't gotten any worse.
It may not be a complete cure. In low concentrations, it could be just a temporary treatment, a palliative that has to be repeated to keep the final stage at bay.
How do we find this, Freezy?
You don't. Not without me to guide you.
Yeah, right.
Oh, you need me, brother. If what we did to you gnomes down in the valley was hell, the homeland in Sienna is hell on wheels. You never get close to that Golondrina without my help.
Let's talk outside a minute.
Feed me! You promised me you'd feed me!
Squinting at the bright morning light, Mildred and Ryan stared across the wide river valley. They could see fire still burning out of control in the no-name ville.
What happens to me is no longer the issue. I don't matter anymore.
What do you mean?
There's a much bigger problem, Ryan. Until now, the Uzis kept a lid on the population and spread of Cannies. Until now, it was 100% fatal. If there's a treatment that lifts that lid, there's nothing to stop the disease and Cannies from overrunning the continent. Every Norman Deathlands is a potential new Canny or Canny victim.
How can we follow a stinking bastard who'd eat his own mother if given the chance?
We don't have any choice other than hiding our heads in the sand. We've got to turn off the spigot once and for all, or every night is going to be like last night, or worse. We've got to find La Golondrina and kill her.
Jack's going to take the news about Sienna triple hard. And the whole crew is going to be mighty unhappy if we bring Junior back alive.
Ville folk aren't going to like it much either. We have to convince them that he's too valuable to chill.
Tough sell all around.
Feed me! Feed me!
Junior won't survive the journey unless we let him eat a little something.
Little is what he's going to get. If we keep the bastard hungry, we keep him honest.
Naked to the waist, except for her army-issue bra, Mildred squatted beside the creek, sloshing her t-shirt in a shallow pool. She washed off the crusted vomit and gore, then wrung it out and pulled it back on, still wet and clinging. No way she could wash the smell from the inside of her nose. The Canny Cave's greasy pall of melted fat and burnt flesh clung to her skin and hair as well. Inside and out, she felt soiled, contaminated. She inventoried her physical state with as much professional detachment as she could manage. In the wake of the forced feeding and projectile vomiting, her stomach ached like she'd swallowed and expelled a 5-pound cannonball. There was no evidence of fever, though. According to Junior Thibodeau, he had come down with symptoms overnight, after his first contact with the Sienna Pack. No flesh-eating on his part. An unlikely outcome, Mildred knew. If Uzi virus was inhaled or absorbed through the skin, it would take several days, perhaps even a week or two, to build up to the point where increased production of white blood cells would cause his body temperature to rise to the fever point. She also knew that brain lesions and radical changes in behavior didn't happen suddenly in the absence of violent head trauma. Mildred concluded that Junior was flat out lying, trying to deflect the blame for his vile actions, which were more voluntary than he wanted to let on. This in order to minimize or eliminate punishment. The wretched, weak-willed bastard didn't want to admit that he had been so easily seduced by the canny lifestyle. Junior had proved himself a liar, so how could she believe him about the existence of the Uzi medicine? He wasn't the only source of that information. The canny with the caved-in head had bragged about it before Junior had dosed her, while they were still in complete control of the situation. So it couldn't have been a lie calculated to keep the miserable bastards alive, or to make her a compliant member of the pack by dangling survival under her nose. Before they left the cave, Mildred and Ryan had decided that she would have the only close contact with Junior. They couldn't be sure how contagious the infection was, and she was already exposed to the max. Mildred checked his shoulder and found a superficial flesh wound, which she cleaned, but didn't bother to stitch. Then, at gunpoint, they turned him loose for a couple of minutes on the deadens. It was damn hard to watch him go at it. He fed like a ravening animal on his own downed pack meat. Mildred couldn't help but think she might be looking at her own future, and even more horrifying, the future of her companions. She had driven Junior off the charred corpse with a sharp blow of her pistol butt on the top of his head. She picked up her gun belt and rose, still dripping, from the creek side. 30 feet upslope, Ryan guarded the canny with his Sig Sauer. Junior's wrists were tied behind him. A thick 4-foot length of tree limb was thrust between his back and crooks of his arms. This served to keep the prisoner bent slightly at the waist, off balance. He couldn't run 5 steps without falling on his face, which made him much easier to handle. They didn't have to keep him on a short leash. Under a clear blue midday sky, they continued across the Grand Ronde Valley. In the distance, the Ville's dirt and log berm was still burning, sending up clouds of brown smoke and soot. As they neared the encampment's perimeter, they could hear the intermittent crunch of shovels gouging the stony earth. When the blinding smoke shifted, it revealed a line of women, children, and oldies digging a long communal grave in the hardpan. On the other side of the trench, more than 20 bodies were lined up on the ground, shoulder to shoulder. Young, old, male, female. Hacked, shot, incinerated. They had manned the barricades and defended the rutted lanes with their lives. Some had died trying to escape the canny wolf packs. Mildred knew there were many more Ville folk missing. On their descent of the valley, she and Ryan had come across numerous sets of tracks in the sand. Twin, parallel tracks made by boot heels. The last impressions of unconscious victims as they were dragged away. Downwind of the diggers, a wide, shallow pit belched low flame and coils of black smoke. Doused with gasoline, the heaped canny dead were burning like garbage on a midden. Mildred visualized 10,000 such narrow Pyrrhic victories, adding up to an unwinnable war against an implacable, ever-growing foe. After the long, valiant struggle up from the radioactive ash heap of Armageddon, it was the end of humanity's hope. With considerable effort, she drove the awful images from her mind.
Stop right there! Stop or we'll fire!
Gun barrels poked over the berm's ridge, and here and there through crude firing ports. Every sight was trained on them.
Who you got there?
Even at a distance, Junior Thibodeau's identity was obvious from his filth, his disfigurement, and his overwhelming carrion stench. One of the grave-digging women pointed at Junior with her shovel.
That's a canny! They caught a canny!
Kill the bastard!
Pump his fucking head!
The column of gravediggers surged forward, waving shovels, clubs, and pickaxes. Mildred and Ryan drew their blasters but held fire. They had no cover. Shooting the diggers would only bring a withering response from the blasters along the berm. For a second, it looked as if they were going to be overrun and surrounded, perhaps summarily clubbed down by the mob. The Ville folk craned their necks to locate the source of the shooting. JB stepped out of the berm gate with a smoking AKS aimed in the air. Mildred figured he had picked up the assault rifle from a dead attacker or defender. Jack, Christy, and Doc followed him, with their guns out and ready. They quickly formed ranks around Mildred, Ryan, and Junior. Shoving, kicking, threatening, they made the diggers retreat toward the gate. The companions regarded the trussed-up canny with surprise and displeasure.
What in the dark night are you doing, Ryan?
Why he not dead?
Jack aimed his .357 revolver at Junior's heart.
Hang him high!
Skin him first!
Junior grinned nervously from around Ryan's back.
Let us have him! Let us punish him! And no harm will come to any of you!
Can't do that! We need him alive for the time being. He's ours. We're not gonna give him up.
Then you're going to die too, canny lover!
Maybe they all gone canny! Chill them all!
Chill them all!
Doc swept the twin muzzles of his Lamar over the crowd of mostly women, children, and geriatrics, shaking his head.
How soon they forget. This, dear friends, is an abomination.
We saved your rad-blasted bacon last night. Wasn't for us, there wouldn't be one of you ungrateful bastards left.
The truth silenced the mob for a moment.
Too many good folks have died here already. Don't make us add to it.
We don't want you here no more!
The Ville folk spread out and blocked the gate with their bodies and grave-digging tools.
Don't matter what you did or didn't do for us last night! We can't trust you today! Take your pet canny and make tracks out of here! That's all the thanks you're going to get!
One of the children picked up a stone and chucked it at them. Another did the same. Soon the companions were being pelted with showers of rocks, large and small.
Ah, fuck it.
There was no pursuit, no long blaster fire from the berm. The Ville folk were content to see them gone.
We have been cast out like lepers.
Like what?
The accursed, the afflicted, the unclean.
The misunderstood.
JB scowled at what were to him unintelligible pre-dark references. He turned on Ryan, scowl intact.
We want an explanation.
Mildred provided it. In clipped, emotionless terms, she described exactly what had been done to her. The companion stood stunned as their battlemate read out her own death sentence. Then JB swung his 12-gauge pump to hip height and advanced on the prisoner with murder in his eye. Mildred blocked his path, pushing the wide barrel aside.
Don't.
Couldn't we catch it too, just from being around him?
She didn't add, and around you. She didn't have to. The companions were incensed, sickened, grief-stricken. But deep down, Mildred knew what they were thinking. That death walked among them. Horrible, lingering death.
If you could catch it that way, you've already got it, Christy. We were all in the cave, in the confined space, all breathing the same contaminated air.
Why haven't you killed that unspeakable degenerate?
Because there might be a cure, Doc. And he's the only one who knows where to find it.
Mildred recounted the story to the companions. She told them about the supposed existence of the Freezy Patient Zero, the putative first victim and the first survivor of the Uzis. She told them about the supposed ability of La Golondrina's blood to prolong the lives of the terminally afflicted. She didn't have to explain the double downside of canny longevity and the resulting spread of infection. Because she owed nothing less than the whole truth to her friends, she also told them about the possibility that the disease and the canny lifestyle were linked.
Tying in canny on us?
Not if the medicine really exists.
If it does exist, and we can find it before the infection takes hold of me, I may have a chance. It's my only chance.
Where is this patient zero?
Louisiana, and what our prisoner there calls the canny homeland.
I know people there. Left friends. Cannies take over?
The companions had recently left Jack's birthplace after taking down an evil baron. How quickly things changed.
How the fuck do I know?
Mildred put her hand on Jack's slim shoulder.
Jack, the only way to find out for sure is to go back.
Correct me if I'm wrong, my dear Ryan, but are you and Mildred proposing that to save her, we six enter the belly of this slouching beast? That we steal its greatest treasure? This life-giving serum, and to forestall any repetition of the threat we currently face, that we hunt down and chill the cannibal's queen?
Nothing less. Any objections?
Though on its face, the task seemed impossible, there was none. One by one, the companions turned toward Mildred and nodded their assent. They had long ago thrown their lots together to do or die. They valued the lives of their comrades more than their own. A pact signed in sweat and blood. A pact of selflessness and sacrifice that served the survival of all.
Looks like we're gonna have to backtrack to the Hell's Canyon Redoubt for another Mattrans jump.
The return trip was a 4-day hike, but it was more than just a hard uphill trek. Their descent along Predark Highway 84 had been perilous, to say the least. Canny snipers had taken potshots at them from the ridgetops all during the day. After dark, the flesh-eaters had come out in force. In beating back the Cannies their third night on the road, the companions had nearly run out of ammo. If they hadn't reached the Vil Berm by nightfall on the fourth day, they never would have survived.
We've got no choice. Walking to Louisiana isn't an option. Check your ammo and food.
We're full up in that department.
JB, Christy, Doc, and Jack had spent their morning searching the Vil's rutted lanes, scavenging appropriate caliber centerfire cartridges from the dead, Norm and Canny, and gathering unspoiled eats. Their pockets and packs bulged with the booty.
And let's get a move on. We've already lost most of the day. We've got to find cover we can defend before sundown.
With Jack in the lead, the companions and their bound captive turned their backs on the ruined Vil and headed north, along the newly christened stretch of the Red Road, the Highway of Blood.